Good evening. Welcome to the third session of Positive Psychology. Tonight's agenda is to review your experiences with the Three Good Things exercise, as well as your experience with the Adaptive Resilience Factor Inventory Assessment, and then a number of questions that we will discuss about the book, The Resilience Factor. Now, would anybody like to report on their experience with the Three Good Things exercise?
I've been, for some time, a few years back, somebody, I think it was 99, a friend gave me a little book, Sarah Van Breathnach journal, that you're supposed to write down five things you're grateful for every day.
Mm-hmm.
And I started doing that. I did that for that year, and then I did it last year and this year. I've been doing that every night before I go to sleep.
Wow.
And it really does, you know, even when you have a rotten day, you can always find five things to be grateful for.
So what has been the result in your outlook on life, having done that exercise for that long?
Well, I'm a fairly optimistic person, but I think it's, you know, it helps keep me centered. Helps remind me how much I have to be thankful for, how many blessings I have.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with her.
Well, that this exercise, when tested by Dr. Martin Seligman, is one that has lasting effects for for about 6 months, even when done for 1 week. Obviously, the longer you do it, the longer the lasting the positive effects. But this is one that has lingering goodness to it.
So, what were the specific effects that he noted?
The effects that he was noticing is was the results that were on the happiness test. That was what they were using for beginning and ending things and during the course of the testing of the experiment. So impacts on just how people were viewing life and how they're feeling positive emotions, I guess. Different way of saying happiness, because happiness means different things to different people.
So. Right.
Okay. Well, let's move forward. The book, The Resilience Factor, did have in it the test called the Resilience Factor Inventory, but online they're at Adaptive. That they have really refined the Resilience Factor Inventory so that it ends up having a measurement on seven different dimensions. So did anybody have a chance to take that assessment?
I did. This is Barbara.
Kathy did.
Is that the adversity?
It's one that you go online at Adaptive and basically
when you end up
with a bar graph indicating where you stand on seven different factors of resiliency.
Right. Okay.
And
all right. No, I didn't.
Okay. And
now what is the R or Q?
Pardon?
What is the R or Q at the end of the bar graph?
Resilience quotient. That is the kind of the average of them.
All right. Okay.
So. As far as an RQ, anybody? I think the adaptive norm RQ is like 71.
Right.
And I came out like an 82, so I'm relatively optimistic and relatively resilient. The interesting thing is when you take a lot of these assessments from from many different directions, to the extent that they corroborate each other. You have greater faith that they're probably right. Either that, or I'm deluded and I consistently answer the questions wrong. So, does anybody have any questions about that? I mostly wanted you to take it just so that you are aware that it's available, and so that you're aware of the seven, more aware of the seven factors that we talked about.
That was very interesting.
So.
It was very interesting. Of course, I ended up with a 71 in the RQ.
Wow, that's surprising. That's not.
Why do you think surprising?
Quite surprising. Because resilience is very closely correlated with optimism, and
mm-hmm.
and. We as coaches all tend to be very optimistic, and if I remember, Barbara's optimism score was fairly good too, wasn't it?
It was very high, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, so that's why it was a bit surprising to me, because one of the questions I've got here is if we jump ahead, what is resilience and how is it different from optimism? Or is it different?
Optimism is more of an attitude, isn't it? Resilience is... it's hard to... it's how you deal with, and I guess it, your attitude is governs how you feel with different situations. And if you're more resilient, you are more optimistic. You tend to be more optimistic. So,
anybody else can add to that?
No.
Very closely related concepts, but the kind of way that I got out of it is optimism is almost like a state of mind. Resilience is. Optimism put into action.
Okay, that makes sense.
And I never heard that stated anywhere like that, but that's how I picture it. Because when you're optimistic, that doesn't have any connotation necessarily of any action. But when you're resilient, that means you must have done something to bounce back.
Right.
Obviously, the more optimistic you are, the more likely you are to bounce back.
Oh, okay.
I asked that question to Dr. Chris Peterson, and really didn't get much of an answer that was very satisfying. So I had to come up with my own.
Well, I like yours.
Yeah. So.
Rick.
Yep.
Can I ask a follow-up question with regard to you're mentioning you were surprised to Barbara's
mm-hmm.
number. Mine is 69. But the reason why I ask is, so it says the adaptive norm is 71. So how to interpret the adaptive norm? Is that low then, or because if you got an 82, are you suggesting that you really want to be a lot higher than the norm, or?
Well, the norm would be the average of the people who have taken it, and that's not to say that the norm is a good representative sample of the total population, but they've probably had enough people take it that it's probably getting close to what the total population would be like, to the extent that greater resiliency and greater optimism is a good thing to be wanted, I would say a higher score than norm would be beneficial. Although, again, I don't know that any any one style or any one frame of mind is right or wrong.
Right.
It just would indicate that there are your likelihood of bouncing back from a setback is greater the more resilient you are. Now, was there any great variance in the factors that you, in your graph?
If it's compared to my profile against the norm, one thing that I did notice, and I was concerned about this as I was answering, in regard to empathy, I recently had a shift in terms of my way of being in the world from projecting and transference to true empathy. You know what I mean? And sometimes you can think that you understand how other people are feeling based on what you are reading, and this is the whole question of what's reality, you know, so it may actually be your projection or your transference as opposed to true ability to assess where that person's coming from because of the variety of ways of determining that without actually asking them, you know, the nonverbals and behavior and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I purposefully, I was very conscious of that as I was answering to make sure that I wasn't answering too highly to suggest that I thought I was always right no matter what, because I think that might suggest that I'm, you know, I don't think anyone can be 100% right about what somebody else is feeling, because we've got to confirm it by asking. But you can get some pretty good information and make some assumptions. So anyway, so I was at 60 and the norm is 70, so there was a part of me that, looking at this, that kind of went, okay, well, I think I know why I'm lower, because I think I'm pretty empathetic, but I was very conscious of how I was answering. I don't know. That's my take on it.
In all these self-reporting assessments, obviously, just how we are interpreting the questions and obviously answering them greatly affects. So, you know, just if you were being super aware, you may or may not have been, you may not have answered it the same as if you'd have just been just going and getting your first impressions, for example.
Sure enough. And I tell you, the other thing that it hit me while I was reading through it were that it said you can't go back once you click next. So I knew I wouldn't be able to go back and change anything I said.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't go back and change anything at all, like when you were finished. Not that I generally do that, but I was very aware that this was different than other things where the system usually you go back and look at a question or whatever. So that also was in my mind.
And felt the pressure of getting it right the first time?
Not so much right, just... I don't know, oftentimes I like to reflect on what seem like similar questions so that I can discern the difference and make sure that I'm giving my true answer, that I'm not conflicting with myself. Obviously, I did a heck of a lot more thinking than was maybe intended.
You're just conflicted.
She sounds like I have a tendency to overthink sometimes. I think Kathy and I have something in common.
Do you think?
Yeah, I think we maybe do.
Well, one of the interesting things about this is the fact that it does break it out by the seven factors, and then it also lists the skill for each of the factors for boosting it up. And so that's that was the source that I used to, when I put the table together in the write-up, starting on page 4, for each of those factors that were listed in your report, then I put down the skills to increase that, so that if you, when you take the test and you see that, well, you're pretty high on some, but well, here's an area that maybe I could get more resilient if I was more skillful in this area. At least you would know what skill could you use to become stronger in that area. So it's that matching of resilience factor with skills that I found particularly useful with this test. So. In the discussion questions, I said, how do mental models affect resiliency? Anybody got a clue?
The mental model.
An example of a mental model is?
Your way of thinking, the way you think the world works, certain cause-effect kinds of relationships that you have in your mind, the way you look at the world.
Well, one way that if you're going to look at the world through a negative viewpoint, your resiliency is not going to be that great for you. It certainly is not optimistic. So it's going to be imperative that you look at it from a positive standpoint of view so that you can be resilient as you are facing all of these other factors. I mean, that's
and I would, yeah, and I would think also if you have a specific, even if you're positive, you have a specific model in mind of the way you think things should be. You're not going to be as resilient.
Right. Then I followed up with a question that are how are the theories of cognitive behavioral theory connected? And I put in this summary the appendix one cognitive behavioral theory starting on page 11 because what I've found is that cognitive behavioral theory came along. Seligman built on that. Then the writers of this resilience factor have built on Seligman's work. So this is kind of a continuous stream of development. But if you've got the printout printed out, on page 12, you know, the old behavioralists thought that there was a stimulus and a response or consequence, with emotion being the consequence. The cognitive behavioral psychologists say no, that's not. It's not quite that direct. There is this cognitive piece in the middle, and that is the thought. That is the mental models that we filter our stimulus through before we have a consequence or a result called emotion. So in a nutshell is cognitive behavioral psychology. And so you can see that how Martin Seligman took that and says, okay, so if you've got learned helplessness or pessimism or depression as that filter, the result is not going to be good. Whereas if you learn how to be more optimistic, then the action or result allows you to be more resilient. So. I find it interesting to see how these different theorists have taken someone's idea and builds on it, and sometimes put different names on it, claims it's something different. Sometimes when it's kind of a continuous thread that goes through these.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that may have been a long aside to put as an appendix, but I just like I said, I was so taken by it was like an aha for me that I just I just wanted to share it.
That's very interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
It's a review. I know I've studied some of these things, but it's been a long time, Don.
The next question I put there for discuss is, what is the value of being aware of our negative thinking?
Your awareness gives you the ability to change it in the moment or, you know, a few minutes later or upon reflection at the end of the day. Or it's huge.
Anybody else?
It also causes you to consider how you might look at a situation in a different way.
Very important. I'm going to build on that thought by jumping to the seventh question I put on there is that I said the missing piece, choice theory. What you just indicated is that if you view a stimulus, you have a chance to think about it. You have a choice of how you're going to respond. Now, animals other than humans react to stimuluses. People have a choice to how to respond. And so why would you want to respond one way versus another?
Because the way you respond has a bearing on the outcome. It has a bearing on how if you're dealing with another person and other people, it has bearing on how they respond back to you.
Mm-hmm. Anybody can build on that?
Your feelings and your emotions. If you are in a negative state, naturally you're going to have a sad, depressive effect on you. Is someone on the telephone?
Not anymore.
Yeah. If the background noise gets too busy, all you have to do is push 6 to mute.
Okay, thank you. I was going to ask about that.
And then to unmute, just push 6 again. Okay?
Thank you.
Okay. Here's what I learned in a personal development course I took in 1988. When you are in this space between stimulus and response, mm-hmm. That is the moment of choice. Okay? And the reason that you would choose one action versus another is what is it that you wish to accomplish? What is your goal? I think, I don't remember whether it was Barbara who said how other people may react. I'm not sure who was speaking there, but if you want to maintain that relationship with that person, you might, in a positive way, you may choose to react entirely different than if you didn't want that relationship any longer. Mm-hmm. Right?
Right.
Right.
So this has tremendous power, the power of self-awareness, and I think I may have shared this with Kathy before, but when I took that course in 1988, I realized that one of the ineffective things that I did was I would blow up at my son Kirk. He would have the tremendous ability to pull my chain. And I was never physically abusive, but I certainly was angry, and that probably wasn't beneficial. It certainly wasn't helping the relationship with Kirk that I wanted. Once I realized that, I became self-aware of that tendency. I only blew up at him once after that, and other times I could feel that coming. I said, whoops. I don't want to go there. Now I have to choose my action. So that self-awareness, just by itself, can be extraordinarily powerful. However, anybody have anything to add to that? However, in the context of building resiliency, that self-awareness also has a very significant impact. Because that is the starting point of the ABC method. On page 5 of the materials, it describes the ABC skill. And in Seligman's model, it's ABCDE, adversity, beliefs, consequences. What was D? Disputation. And
yeah.
E was the energize. So, so again, it's the same. I mean, these folks have built right on what Seligman did. And A, B, and the C is exactly what the cognitive behavioral psychologists were calling stimulus, thought, and emotion. Okay. But the first thing you need to do is to become aware of what adversities pull your chain. Or, as the table on page 18 talks about, which adversities push your buttons. There are a number of different kinds of things that can trigger you. This is, I'm sure, not anywhere close to complete. So what I did was went back to the materials from that class that I took way back in 88 and put together these lists of ineffectives. Because these are also kinds of attitudes or beliefs or whatever that may trigger or may cause you to think of, oh yeah, something happens which makes me think that. Just another way to try to identify an adversity so that you can begin the process of doing this ABC method. So awareness is the start of all this whole thing. That's so that you can become aware of the adversity that it's likely to trigger. But what this whole method is a matter of tracking it kind of in the moment, keeping track of things, and you have an adversity, or at the end of the day you think of the adversities that you may have had. I guess it's better not to do this at the end of the day, because you don't want to mix that up with the three great things. But if you can keep track of the kinds of adversities that you had and the consequences or the emotions that you had, then you can start working with this tool. You may not yet have identified the belief that's in the middle. The real useful aha that's in the book, and it's not exactly buried, but they don't make that big a deal of it, is the table on page 6. If we are probably more aware of what our emotions are than the underlying beliefs. So if you track what the adversity was and you track what the emotion was, then the trick is to try to figure out, okay, so what belief got triggered? And if you work backwards, so let's say you felt embarrassed. Then you can look backwards to say the belief is probably some version of a negative comparison to others. Where'd that one come from? gives you a way to kind of track back, and so you can map out that whole chain of adversity, belief, and consequence. They say that these five things, five beliefs, always go together with these five consequences or emotions. I'm not sure that that's been proven, but that's what they say. You might want to try that out and see if it works for you. When you get an emotion triggered, you may want to pull this out and say, that emotion, what belief? Some version of I'm angry. Some version of my rights being violated. So.
What does the type mean? Does that mean you don't understand why that happened, or?
Right. It's you understand why you got angry.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I have to go back and look at, make sure I have that really down pat myself. The type. I didn't explain it here, and off the top of my head, I don't remember all of that. So that's the exercise that they recommend. Identify adversities. Identify the emotions. Begin to keep track of them. Going back and either thinking of what that belief was that preceded the emotion, or if you can't remember or you can't dig it up, check the table and see if you can help build that so that you can see that chain. Now, that doesn't necessarily solve the problem because there are other pieces that that may need to be done. Now, what was the next piece in learned optimism? The disputation. That really is without their naming it that. If you go to middle of page 7, there's the paragraph that says, once you've identified your beliefs, you can begin to challenge them. Okay, so that's. That's one of the steps, or we can actually now jump to let me think here. The ABC model was one of the skills. When we move to page 9. One of the change skills that he talked about is challenging the beliefs, which are what Dr. Seligman called it, the D of the disputation model. So that's where you really begin to think of, okay, is that always true? In time, is it applicable in all things? Did I cause it or did someone else cause it? In other words, those permanent, pervasive, and personal ways to look at things that Seligman came up with, you can challenge that it's those three ways. And just kind of look for the evidence that may not support that belief. Okay, I'm going to turn back to another page, to page 8. One of the other skills that the authors talked about was avoiding thinking traps or thinking errors. Because there are all kinds of different ways to think poorly. The ones that they mention, jump into conclusions, what did we call that in mental models? You call that leaps to abstraction?
All right.
Yeah. Overgeneralizing would be very, very similar to that. tunnel vision may be part of those filters that we've got, so that we don't even see the other things going on around us. So there's a number of different kinds of thinking traps. From another source, I pull together other patterns of negative thinking. Appendix 2, starting on page 15, to some extent this is overlap. For example, both have emotional reasoning. Polarized thinking could be very similar to magnifying or minimizing, but there's other types of negative thinking, maybe blaming or shoulds, musts, and oughts, polarized thinking, catastrophizing, avoiding thinking traps, magnifying and minimizing, that again, that's catastrophizing, entitlement, so forth. And then on page 16, there are ways to dispute those or to check to see if those are, that thinking is accurate or not. So I'm not sure what source I got that one, that stuff from, but probably something from 1988, because I got so much out of those. Okay. Page 9, talking about iceberg beliefs. Anybody want to talk about that? What's that all about?
This is Barbara again. I think what I got out of the iceberg beliefs is sometimes it comes from children. It could come from your parents. Whatever your parents has taught you or what they believed in, you take those same beliefs on with yourself, and it just becomes a way of life for you, and you fall within a category of, but my parents said so, and I believe it.
And why might they call it an iceberg belief?
Because it was acceptable to you.
Sounds like it's submerged.
Yeah, in your unconscious sort of habit, as opposed to...
It's in those tapes that are in your head.
Yeah, and maybe just a little bit of it is showing, but the bulk of it is totally buried.
Mm-hmm. Subconscious?
Yeah. So you might get a glimpse of it once in a while, but for the most part, it's buried there. And one of the things that, when they're talking about trying to figure out or identifying your underlying beliefs so that you can then challenge them. And one of the ways they're saying that the steps to identify as iceberg belief is if your emotion is way out of proportion to what happened, you can wonder, where did that come from? There's a good chance that there's an iceberg belief in between there. And if you can uncover that iceberg belief, you would be much more likely to understand, you know, what's going on. And if you ever have a situation where you wondered why you reacted as strongly as you did, or you wondered why someone else reacted as strongly as they did?
Oh, yeah.
There was something going on in either your head or their head that wasn't very, very obvious. Of course, back many years ago, I'm trying to think of what it's called. Lifts my mind right now. Anyway, the books a long time ago, and I'm Okay, You're Okay, and The Games People Play by Eric Byrne, Transactional Analysis, that's what I'm trying to think of. There was the game that was described as cashing in your S&H stamps. Remember what S&H stamps were?
S&H green stamps.
S&H green stamps, yes. Basically, the idea that some people would just save a little hurt, another little hurt, and another little hurt, another little hurt, until they have enough of them, and then that justified them to blow up. They cash them in for a prize. So it may not be an iceberg belief, that they just may be playing the game of cashing in their S&H green stamps.
Oh, wow.
So. Okay. What we're going to be talking about more about is, and part of the homework assignment for next time is really working with this ABC model and challenging the beliefs. I'm going to be asking you to keep track of some of the adversities and really working with this model a little bit, and just trying to identify some of those negative feelings, some of those adversities that may come up, and really be thinking if you can you build a whole chain from something that happened, what your emotion was, and then building back to what that intervening belief was. These skills here are really the critical part for that.
This is Barbara. I just had a question here on page 9, where it was talking about the steps to detect the iceberg beliefs. Check whether your C's are out of proportion, or check whether the quality of your C's is mismatched. Now, is this part of the ABCs?
Yes.
You check your
the C's is the consequence or emotion, and
okay.
B is the belief.
Right.
Yep.
Okay. The consequences. Yep. Okay.
Yeah, sorry, I ended up using a little bit of shorting two words, abbreviations there that I shouldn't have. But yeah, it's see where your emotions are in proportion with the beliefs, what they're talking about.
All right. And
yeah.
The C would be the consequences of whatever that is that's going to happen.
Right.
Okay.
Number 5, putting in perspective is a very, very useful tool. And for those people particularly who worry a lot, this is probably pretty similar in I think one of Dale Carnegie's books about simply asking the question, if something happens, what's the worst that can happen? What's the best that can happen? What's the most likely thing that will happen? And there's other intervening questions that are listed on page 10 is, is there anything one thing I can do to stop the worst from happening? Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. What's the one thing I can do to make the best thing happen? In other words, we're not just victims. We may be able to affect the result. And so if you think through that process, oftentimes you can avoid catastrophizing something. People who are worrywarts have a particularly difficult time with that exercise because they tend to see what's most likely, they see as most likely the worst. Here's something that should be near and dear to many of your hearts, calming and focusing. Kathy, when you want to calm yourself, what do you do?
Deep breathing, almost just immediately go into meditation.
The quickest thing you can do on the spot is deep breathing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I always find the best thing to do is make sure you keep a paper bag around the house all the time and breathe in and out of that paper bag. It helps with hyperventilating.
Is the paper bag helpful to keep from hyperventilating?
Well, you breathe in and out. You breathe into the bag, and you come up, and you take a breath, and let the air out, and you breathe into it again.
Oh, okay. Okay. I wasn't sure whether the bag would help, if you breathe in and out of the bag, whether that helped maintain a proper carbon dioxide level or whatever, because oftentimes when you, if you start breathing real hard and too fast, you can just build up the oxygen and you know, you can hyperventilate. But really the deep breathing is just really slow in and slow out.
Right.
So
just
kind of still your mind if you can. So
I count that.
That can work too. I also do, it's a little bit of a Tai Chi move, and it's just my arms on the side, on my sides, and as I breathe in, I raise my arms up to the top, and as I breathe out, I slowly let my arms down, and kind of a stretching move at the same time, and it also, you know, it's not appropriate. You're in the middle of a meeting or something, and something happens, and you want to react. You can't stand up and start waving your arms around. But you still need to have a mechanism to calm and focus. And there's that old technique again. Write it down and do it. Take care of it tomorrow. Scarlett O'Hara again. I'll think about this tomorrow. So the greatest skill of this also comes what they call real-time resiliency. And so that's being able to really go through these processes on the spot. Instead of reacting, you go through this alternatives, evidence, implications, exercise, again, that Dr. Seligman laid out. These folks did some nice extensions from Seligman's work, but there's really not a whole lot new here, but a different way of looking at what Dr. Martin Seligman did, and in such rather useful format. So, does anybody have any questions, suggestions, comments from here?
No.
Or takeaways from tonight's session?
The only comment that I would have is that the information has been very informative, and it certainly will aid and help me in some areas of weaknesses within myself.
This is Kathy. I think it's going to be very telling to work through, as you suggested, tracking the adversities and trying to get the beliefs in between the consequences and seeing where I will end up next week.
Yeah,
and this is Ellen. Yeah, I was going to say, I think that it's providing some tools that will be really helpful in increased self-awareness, but also helpful in use with clients as well.
Well, that's one of the reasons I wanted to point you to these various tests that are available free. To the extent that they are useful with your clients, obviously they're there. I'll be sending you the assignments for next time. But what I'd like you to do is continue to do the three good things for another week. Or if you haven't been doing those, to start doing those. Next is logging the negative feelings and trying to build that ABC chain. See how that works for you. And then I'm going to send you the link for one other test. It's called the Values in Action IS. I forget what the IS stands for. VIA-IS Strengths Test. This is the test that Dr. Martin Seligman and Dr. Chris Peterson developed together to identify what your strengths are. The homework from the last session will be, the fourth session will be using your strengths in a new way. Now, that was one of the that was the third method that was tested to be effective in building your happiness. And so we'll first of all, with the test, try to find out what that what those strengths are. And when you take the test, it'll be your five signature strengths will be noted, and then that'll give you some idea on what you might want to build on. Now, as a look ahead for strengths, there is a little bit of difference of opinion as far as what strengths are. When Dr. Martin Seligman and Chris Peterson did their strengths tests, they were looking at universal strengths that were universal across cultures and across time. Now, the Gallup organization also has a strengths test called the Clifton Strengths Finder, which has a different number of strengths and different list of strengths. Now, that is more culturally specific to more like the workplace. So in practice, which is better to use may be a good question. But the question goes beyond that, because what a strength is in the end is not what is really being identified in these tests. What is identified is, relative to you, what is your greatest strength? Now, everybody's going to have believe it or not, everybody's going to have a five greatest strengths. Like, half the class is always below average, just by definition. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a very well-developed strength. So one of the things in Marcus Buckingham's recent books that really was talking about is these tests really measure more or less a talent or a tendency that is strong within you based on the patterns in your brain that have been developed when you were young. And for it to become a true strength, then that's where you have to add your skills and knowledge to make it a true strength. But taking this test is a good first step in trying to figure that out. But don't read more into it than there is. Anything
okay.
else? Well, I appreciate your being on the call again tonight, and look forward to talking to you next time.
Thanks, Rick.
Thank you.
It's been very
good.
And for those
good
of you,
too.
And those of you who will be at the Michigan Survives meeting Thursday night, I'll see you there.
See ya.
Yep. Bye.
Bye-bye.